This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC 50311, Black Friday by James Patterson. Copyright 2000 by James Patterson. Read by Bob Moore. This book contains 450 pages on 8 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. When terrorists target Wall Street, Federal Agent Arch Carroll joins SEC Chief of Enforcement Caitlin Dillon to determine who is behind the mayhem. But their investigation endangers the motherless Carroll children. Violence, strong language, and some explicit descriptions of sex. Bestseller, 1986. From the book jacket. A string of number one blockbusters from Along Came a Spider to Cat and Mouse. Now read James Patterson's Black Friday. The breathtaking suspense of Kiss the Girls and the authenticity of NYPD Blue. Welcome to James Patterson's classic super thriller, Black Friday. A courageous federal agent, a powerful and resourceful woman lawyer. Only they can possibly stop the unspeakable from happening. New York City is under siege by a secret militia group, and that's just the beginning of the relentless terror of Black Friday. About the author. James Patterson is the author of 7 major national bestsellers. Other books by James Patterson. Season of the Machete. The Thomas Berryman Number. See How They Run. Black Market. The Midnight Club. Hide and Seek. Jack and Jill. When the Wind Blows. For Janie, who is Nora. For Mary Catherine, who is a saint. For anyone who's ever dreamed about some small and delicious revenge against the money changers on Wall Street and around the world. Acknowledgements. Although Black Friday is written as fiction, all of what follows could happen, especially the Wall Street financial parts. I would like to thank the people who helped so much in making the background information interesting and authentic. Sidney Ruthberg, financial editor, Fairchild Publications. James Dowd, Wall Street attorney, formerly of the United States Army. Stephen Bowen, former captain, United States Marine Corps. Catherine McMahon, New York and Paris backgrounds. Joan Ennis, Irish Tourist Board. Thomas Altman, Sedona, Arizona. Barbara Madalena, New York, Wall Street area. Mindy Zepp, New York. M. Blackstone, Soho. Part 1. Green Band. The Pure Products of America Go Crazy. William Carlos Williams. Chapter 1. Colonel David Hudson leaned his tall, athletic body against the squat, battered trunk of one of New York's checker-style taxis. Raising one hand to his eye, Hudson loosely curled his fingers to fashion a telescope. He began to watch morning's earliest light fall on the Wall Street scene. He carefully studied 40 Wall Street, where Manufacturers Hanover Trust had offices, then number 23 Wall, which housed executive suites for Morgan Guarantee, the New York Stock Exchange Building, Trinity Church, Chase Manhattan Plaza. Once he had it all vividly in sight, Colonel Hudson squeezed his fingers tightly together. "Boom," he whispered quietly. The financial capital of the world completely disappeared behind his clenched right fist. Boom. Seconds before 5:30 on that same morning, Sergeant Harry Simkowski, the man designated as Vets 24, sped down the steep, icicle-slick Metropolitan Avenue hill in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn. He was riding in a 9-year-old Everest and Jennings wheelchair from the Queens VA. Right now, he was pretending the chair was a Datsun 280Z, silver metallic with a shining T-roof. "Hey-ya!" he let out a banshee screech that pierced the deserted, solemnly quiet morning streets. His long, thin face was buried in the oily collar of a khaki army fatigue parka, replete with peeling sergeant stripes, and his frizzy blonde ponytail blew behind him like ribboning bike streamers. Periodically, he closed his eyes, which were tearing badly in the burning cold wind. His tightly pinched face was getting as red as the gleaming Berry Street spotlight he was racing through with absolute abandon. His forehead was burning, but he loved the sensation of unexpected freedom. He thought he could actually feel streams of blood surge through both his wasted legs again. Harry Stemkowski's rattling wheelchair finally came to a halt in front of the all-night Walgreens drugstore. Under the fatigue jacket and the two bulky sweaters he wore, his heart was hammering wildly. He was so goddamn excited. His whole life was beginning all over again. Today, Harry Stemkowski felt he could do just about anything. The drugstore's glass door, which he nudged open, was covered with a montage of cigarette posters. Almost immediately, he was blessed with a draft of welcoming warm air, filled with the smells of greasy bacon and fresh, perked coffee. He smelled and rubbed his hands together in a gesture that was almost gleeful. For the first time in years, he was no longer a cripple. And for the first time in more than a dozen hard years, Harry Stemkowski had a purpose. He had to smile. When he wrapped his mind around the whole deal, the full, unbelievable implications of Green Band, he just had to smile. Right at this moment, Sergeant Harry Stemkowski, the official messenger for Green Band, was safely at his fire base inside New York City. Now everything could begin. Chapter 2. Inside the fortress that was New York FBI headquarters in Federal Plaza, a tall, silver-haired man, Walter Trentkamp, repeatedly tapped the eraser of his pencil against the faded desk blotter. Scrawled on the soiled blotter was a single phone number, 202-456-1414. It was a private number for the White House, a direct line to the President of the United States. Trentkamp's telephone rang at 6 exactly. All right, everybody, please start up audio surveillance now. It was early in the morning, and his voice was harsh. I'll hold them as long as I possibly can. Is audio surveillance ready? Well, let's go then. The FBI Eastern Bureau chief cleared his throat self-consciously. Then he picked up the telephone. The words Green Band echoed perilously inside his brain. He'd never known anything like this in his Bureau experience, which was long and varied and not without bizarre encounters. Gathered in a grim, tight circle around the FBI head were some of the more powerfully connected men and women in New York. Not a person in the group had ever experienced anything like this emergency situation either. In silence, they listened to Trentkamp answer the expected phone call. This is the Federal Bureau. Hello? There was no answer over the outside line. The tension inside the room was as sharp as the cutting edge of a surgical blade. Even Trentkamp, whose calm in critical police situations was well known, appeared nervous and uncertain. I said hello. Is anyone there on the line? Is anyone out there? Who is on this line? Walter Trentkamp's tentative, frustrated voice was being electronically monitored and a battered mahogany phone booth at the rear of the Walgreens drugstore in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Inside the booth, Sergeant Harry Stemkowski finger-combed his hair as he listened. His heart had gone beyond mere pounding. Now it was threatening to detonate inside his chest. There were new and unusual pulses beating all through his body, opening and closing with the sharpness of mechanical claws. This was the long-overdue time of truth. There would be no more war game rehearsals for the 28 members of Green Band. Hello? This is Trentkamp, New York FBI. The plain black phone receiver cradled between Stemkowski's shoulder and his jaw seemed to tremble and vibrate on each phrase. After another interminable minute, Harry Stemkowski firmly depressed the play button on a Sony 114 portable recorder. He then carefully held the pocket recorder flush against the payphone's receiver. Stemkowski had cued the recorder to the first word of the message. Good. The good stretched to good as the recorder hitched once, then rolled forward with a soft whir. Good morning. This is Greenband speaking. Today is December 4th, a Friday, a history-making Friday, we believe. Over a squawk box, the eerie, high-pitched voice brought the unprecedented message the men and women sequestered inside the Manhattan FBI office had been waiting for. Greenband was beginning. Ryan Clouk, from FBI surveillance, made a quick judgment that the pre-recorded track had been perfectly speeded up and echoed to sound even more eerie than the circumstance made it, to be virtually unrecognizable, probably untraceable. As we promised, there are vitally important reasons for our past phone calls this week, for all the elaborate preparations we've made and had you make to date. Is everyone listening? I can only assume you have company, Mr. Trent Kent. No one in corporate America seems to make a decision alone these days. Listen closely, then. Everybody, please listen. The Wall Street Financial District, from the East River to Broadway, is scheduled to be firebombed today. A large number of randomly selected targets will be completely destroyed late this afternoon. I will repeat. Selected targets in the Wall Street Financial District will be destroyed today. Our decision is irrevocable. Our decision is non-negotiable. The firebombing of Wall Street will take place at 5 minutes past 5 tonight. It might be an attack by air. It might be a ground attack. Whichever, it will occur at 5 minutes past 5 precisely. Wait a minute, you can't. Walter Trentkamp vehemently began to object. Then he stopped just as suddenly. He remembered he was attempting to talk back to a recorded message. All of Manhattan, everything below 14th Street, must be evacuated. The voice track continued methodically. The target area nuclear survival plan for New York should be activated right now. Are you listening, Mayor Ostro? Susan Hamilton from the Office of Civil Preparedness? The nuclear target plan can save thousands of lives. Please employ it now. In case any of you require further concrete convincing, this will be provided as well. Such requests have been anticipated. Our seriousness, our utter commitment to this mission, must not be underestimated, not at any time during this or any future talk we might decide to have. Begin the evacuation of the Wall Street Financial District now. Green Band cannot possibly be stopped or deterred. Nothing I've said is negotiable. Our decision is irrevocable. Harry Stemkowski abruptly pushed down the stop button. He quickly replaced the telephone receiver. He then rewound the Sony recorder and stuffed it in the drooping pocket of his army fatigue jacket. Done. He took a deep breath that seemed to grab into the very pit of his stomach. He shivered uncontrollably. Christ, he'd done it. He'd actually goddamn done it. He delivered Green Band's message and he felt terrific. He wanted to scream out inside the drugstore. More than that, he wished he could leap 2 feet in the air and punch the sky. No formal demands had been made. Not a single clue had been offered as to why Green Band was happening. Harry Stemkowski's heart was still beating loudly as he numbly maneuvered his wheelchair along an aisle lined with colorful deodorants and toiletries up toward the gleaming soda fountain counter. The short order cook, Wally Lipsky, a cheerfully mountainous 310-pound man, turned from scraping the grill as Stemkowski and his wheelchair approached. Lipsky's pink-cheeked face immediately brightened. The semblance of a third or fourth chin appeared out of rolling mounds of neck fat. "Well, look what Sylvester the Cat must have dragged in off of the street. It's my man, Pennsylvania. Where you been keeping yourself, Champ? Long time no see." Henry Stemkowski had to smile at the irresistible fat cook, who had a well-deserved reputation as the Greenpoint neighborhood clown. Hell, he was in the mood to smile at almost anything this morning. "Oh, he here and there, Wally," Harry Stemkowski burst into a nervous stutter. "Manhattan the most part. I've been working up in Manhattan a lot these days." Stemkowski tapped his index finger against the tattered cloth tag sewn into the shoulder of his jacket. The patch said, "Vets, Cabs, and Messengers." Harry Stemkowski was one of seven licensed wheelchair cabbies in New York. Three of them worked for Vets in Manhattan. "Got a good job. Real job now. Wally, why don't you make us some breakfast?" "You got it, Pennsylvania. Cab driver special coming up. You got it, my man. Anything you want." Chapter 3. As early as 6:15 that morning, an endless stream of sullen-looking men and women carrying bulging black briefcases had begun to rise out of the steam-blooming subway station at Broadway and Wall Street. These were the appointed drones of New York's financial district, the straight salary employees who understood abstract accounting principles and fine legal points, but perceived little else about the street and its black magic. By 7:30, gum-popping secretaries were slouching off the red and tan line buses arriving from Staten Island and Brooklyn. Aside from their habitual gum-chewing, several of the secretaries looked impressively chic, almost elegant, that Friday morning. As the ornate golden arms on the Trinity Church clock solemnly reached for 8 o'clock, every main and side street of the financial district was choked with thick, hyper-tense pedestrian traffic, as well as with buses and honking cabs. Over 950,000 people were being melted into less than half a square mile of outrageously expensive real estate. Seven solid stone blocks, where billions were bought and sold every workday. Still the unsurpassed financial capital of the world. The New York police hadn't known whether or not to try and stop the morning's regular migration. Then it was simply too late. The slim possibility had disintegrated in a frantic series of telephone calls between the commissioner's office and various powerful precinct chiefs. It had petered out into a nightmare of impossible logistics and mounting panic. At that moment, a wraith-like black man, Abdul Calvin Muhammad, was very calmly entering the bobbing parade of heads and winter hats on Broad Street, just south of Wall. As he walked within the spirited crowd, Calvin Muhammad found himself noticing corporate flags waving colorfully from a massive stone building. The flags signaled BBH and Company, the National Bank of North America, Manufacturers Hanover, the Siemens Bank. The flags were like crisp sails driven by strong East River winds. Calvin Muhammad continued up the steep hill toward Wall Street. He was hardly noticed. But then the messenger caste usually wasn't. They were invisible men. Today, like every other workday, Calvin Muhammad wore a thigh-length, pale gray clerk's tunic with a frayed armband that said, "Vets Messengers." On either side of the capitalized words were fierce 82nd Airborne Fighting Eagles. But none of that was noticed either. Calvin Muhammad didn't look like it now, but in Vietnam and Cambodia, he'd been a Kit Carson Army Scout. He'd won a Distinguished Service Cross, then the Medal of Honor for conspicuous gallantry at the risk of his life. After returning to the U.S. in 1971, Muhammad had been rewarded by a grateful society with jobs as a porter at Penn Station, a delivery boy for Chick Terry, a baggage carrier at LaGuardia Airport. Calvin Muhammad, Vets 11, unslung his heavy messenger's shoulder bag as he reached the graffiti-covered newsstand at the corner of Broadway and Wall. He tapped out a cool and lit up behind the plume of yellow flame. Slouched in a nearby doorway, Vets 11 then casually reached into his shoulder bag and slid out a standard U.S. Army field telephone. Still concealed in the deep cloth bag was a 16-inch machine gun pistol, along with half a dozen 40-millimeter anti-personnel grenades. Contact. He moved back into the cold building shadows, then whispered into the field telephone. This is Vets 11 at the Stock Exchange. I'm at the northeast entrance, off wall. Everything's very nice and peaceful at position 3. No police in sight. No armed resistance anywhere. Almost looks too easy. Over. Vets 11 took another short drag on his dwindling cigarette. He calmly peered around at the noisy hustle and bustle that was so characteristic of Wall Street on a weekday. Broad daylight. What an amazing, completely unbelievable scene, just to imagine the apocalyptic firefight that would be coming down here at 5 o'clock. At 08:30, Calvin Muhammad carefully wound a tattered strip of cloth around the polished brass door handle at the back entrance of the all-powerful New York Stock Exchange, a proud, beautiful green band. Chapter 4. Green Band started savagely and suddenly, as if meteors had hurtled themselves with malevolent intensity against New York City. It blew out two-story-tall windows and shattered asphalt roofs and shook whole streets in the vicinity of Pier 33-34 on 12th Avenue between 12th and 15th Streets. It all came in an enormous white flash of painful, blinding light. At approximately 9:20 that morning, Pier 33-34, which had once hosted such regal ships as the Queen Elizabeth and the QE2, was a sudden fiery cauldron, a crucible of flame that raked the air and spread with such rapid intensity that even the Hudson River seemed to be spurting colossal columns of flame, some at least 400 feet high. Dense hydrocarbon clouds of smoke bloomed over 12th Avenue like huge black umbrellas being thrown open. 6-foot-long shards of glass, unguided missiles of molten steel, were flying upward, launching themselves in eerie, tumbling slow motion. And as the river winds suddenly shifted, there were otherworldly glimpses of the glowing, red-hot metal skeleton that was the pier itself. The blistering fireball had erupted and spread in less than 60 seconds' time. It was precisely as the Green Band warning had said it would be, an unspeakable sound and light show, a ghostly demonstration of promised horrors and terrors to come. The dock for the Mauritania, for the Aquitania, the Ile-de-France, had been effectively vaporized by the powerful explosions, by the sudden, graphic flash fires. This time, one of the thousands of routinely horrifying threats to New York was absolutely real. Radio listeners and TV viewers all over New York would soon hear the unprecedented message, "This is not a test of the emergency broadcast system." At 10:35 on the morning of December 4th, more than 7,000 dedicated capitalists, dot system clerks, youthful pages with their jaunty epaulets and floppy Connecticut Yankee haircuts, grimly determined stockbrokers, bond analysts, bright green-jacketed supervisors were busily, if somewhat nonchalantly, promenading through the three jam-packed main rooms of the New York Stock Exchange. The 12 elevated ticker-tape TV monitors in the busy room were spewing stock symbols and trades comprehensible only to the trained eyes of exchange professionals. The day's volume, if it was only an average Friday, would easily exceed 150 million shares. The original forebears, the first bears and bulls, had been ferocious negotiators and boardroom masters. Their descendants, however, their mostly thin-blooded heirs, were not particularly adroit at money changing. At 10:57 on Friday morning, the bell, which had once actually been a brass fire bell struck by a rubber mallet, and which still signaled the official beginning of trading at 10 sharp, the end of trading at 4, went off inside the New York Stock Exchange. The bell sounded with all the shock value of a firework popping in a cathedral. Absolute silence followed. Shocked silence. Then came uncontrollable buzzing, frantic rumor trading, almost 3 minutes of unprecedented confusion and chaos on the stock exchange floor. Finally, there was the deep and resonant voice of the stock exchange manager blaring over the antiquated PA system. "Gentlemen, ladies, the New York Stock Exchange is officially closed. Please leave the stock exchange floor. Please leave the trading floor immediately. This is not a bomb scare. This is an actual emergency. This is a serious police emergency." Chapter 5. Outside the heavy stone and steel entranceway to the Mobile Building on East 42nd Street, a series of personal stretch limousines, Mercedes, Lincolns, Rolls-Royces, were arriving and departing with dramatic haste. Important-looking men and a few women, most of them in dark overcoats, hurriedly disembarked from the limousines and entered the building's familiar deco lobby. Upstairs on the 42nd floor, other CEOs and presidents of the major Wall Street banks and brokerage houses were already gathered inside the exclusive Pinnacle Club. The emergency meeting had commandeered the luxurious main dining room of the private club, which was glowing with crisp white linen, shining silver and crystal setup, and never used for lunch. Several of the dark-suited executives stood dazed and disoriented before floor-to-ceiling non-glare windows, which faced downtown. None of them had ever experienced anything remotely like this, nor had they ever expected to. The view was a spectacular, if chilling one, down uneven canyons to lower Manhattan, all the way to the pencil pocket of skyscrapers, which was the financial center itself. About halfway at 14th Street, there were massive police barricades, police department buses, EMS ambulances, and a parade-like crowd could be seen waiting, watching Wall Street as if they were studying some puzzling work of art in a Midtown museum. None of this was possible. It was sheer madness. Every rational mind in the executive dining room had already reached this conclusion privately. "They haven't even bothered to reestablish contact with us, not since 6 this morning," said the Secretary of Treasury, Walter O'Brien. "What the hell are they up to?" Standing stiffly among 4 or 5 prominent Wall Street executives, George Firth, the Attorney General of the United States, was quietly relighting his pipe. He appeared surprisingly casual and controlled, except that he'd given up smoking more than 3 years before. "They certainly were damned clear when it came to stating their deadline. 5 minutes past 5. 5 minutes past for what? What do the bastards want from us?" The Attorney General's pipe went out in his hand, and he relit it with a look of exasperation. Madness. What they'd experienced for a decade in terrorist plagued Europe, but never before in the United States. A somber businessman named Gerald Gottlieb from Lehman Brothers held up his wristwatch. "Well, gentlemen, it's 5:01. He looked as if he were about to add something, but whatever it was, he left it unsaid. But that was the unlikely place they had all entered now. An unfamiliar territory where things couldn't be properly articulated, the uncharted territory of the unspeakable. They've been extremely punctual up to now, almost obsessive about getting details and schedules perfect. They'll call. I wouldn't worry. They'll call." The speaker was the Vice President of the United States, who'd been rushed from the UN to the nearby Mobile Building. Thomas More Elliott was a stern man with the look of an Ivy League scholar. He was a Brahmin who was out of touch with the complexities of contemporary America, his harshest critics carped. For the next 180 seconds, there was almost uninterrupted silence in the Pinnacle Club dining room. This tingling silence was all the more frightening because there were so many highly articulate men crowded into the room. The senior American business executives, used to having their own way, used to being listened to and obeyed almost without question. Now their voices were stilled, virtually powerless. Their power, normally awesome, had distilled itself into a sequence of small, distinct noises. the scratchy rasp of a throat being cleared, ice cracking in a glass with an almost glacial effect, the tapping of fingers on the bowl of a dead pipe. Madness. The thought seemed to echo in the room. The most fearsome urban terrorism had finally struck deep inside the United States, stabbing right to the heart of America's economic power. There were anxious, repeated glances at the glinting faces of Rolex, Cartier, and Piaget wristwatches. What did Green Band want? Where were the final demands? What was the no doubt outrageous ransom for Wall Street to be? Edward Palin, the 77-year-old chief executive of one of the largest investment firms, had to slowly back away from the darkly reflected picture windows. A few of the others embarrassedly watched as he sat down in a Harvard chair pulled up beside one of the dining tables and, in a gesture that was almost poignant, put his head between his gray, pinstriped knees. There were less than 20 seconds left to the expiration of the Green Band deadline. "Please call. Call, you bastards," the vice president muttered. What seemed like thousands of emergency sirens were screaming a peculiar high-low wail all over New York. It was the first time the emergency warning system had been seriously in use since 1963 and the nuclear war scares. Finally, it was 5:05. The sudden, terrifying realization struck every person in the Pinnacle Club's dining room. They weren't going to call again. They weren't going to negotiate. Without any further warning, Green Band was going to strike. "A fast recap for you," said Lisa Pelham, who was the president's chief of staff, an efficient, well-organized woman who spoke in the clipped manner of one whose mind was used to making succinct outlines from mountains of information. By 12 noon, all trading had been halted on the New York and all regional exchanges in the U.S. There is no trading in London, Paris, Geneva, Bonn. The key New York business people are meeting right now at the Pinnacle Club inside the Mobile Building. All the important securities and commodities exchanges have ceased trading around the world. The unanswered question is the same everywhere. What's the nature of the demands we are secretly negotiating? Lisa Pelham paused and stroked a strand of hair away from her oval face. "Everyone believes we are negotiating with somebody, sir." "And we are definitely not?" President Justin Kearney's expression was one of extreme doubt and suspicion. He had discovered the awkward fact during his term of office that one branch of government all too frequently didn't know what another was doing. "Which we are not, Mr. President. Both the CIA and FBI have assured us of that. Sir, Green Band has still made no demands." President Justin Kearney had been rushed under intensified Secret Service guard to a windowless, lead-shielded room buried deep inside the White House. There, in the White House Communications Center, several of the most important political leaders in the United States were standing around the president in a manner that suggested they intended to protect him. From the White House Communications Center, the president had been put into audio and visual contact with a Pinnacle Club in New York City. The FBI chief, Walter Trentkamp, stepped forward to appear on the monitor screen from New York. Trentkamp had short, silver-gray hair. Time and his job had also added a tough, weathered policeman's look and a harassed attitude to match. "There's been no further contact from Green Band other than the firebombing of Pier 3334, which is the demonstration they promised us, Mr. President." "It's the kind of guerrilla warfare we've seen in Belfast, Beirut, Tel Aviv. Never before in the United States." "We're all waiting, Mr. President," Trentkamp went on. "It's 5:06 and about 40 seconds. We're clearly past their stated deadline." "Have any of the terrorist groups come forward and claimed responsibility?" "They have. We're checking into them. So far, none has shown any knowledge of the content of the warning phone call this morning." 5:06 became 5:07. The time was leaden. 5:07 became 5:08. A minute had never seemed so long. It was 5:09, 5:10, and slowly, slowly counting. The director of the CIA moved before the lights and cameras in the White House emergency room. Philip Berger was a small, irascible man, highly unpopular in Washington, chiefly skilled at keeping the major American intelligence agencies competitive among themselves. Is there any activity you can make out on Wall Street? Any people down there? Any moving vehicles? Small plane activity? Nothing, Phil, apart from the police, the fire department vehicles on the periphery of the area. It could be a peaceful Sunday morning. They're goddamn bluffing, someone said in Washington. Or, President Kearney said, they are playing an enormous game of fucking nerves. No one agreed or disagreed with the president. No one said anything now. Speech had been replaced by the terrifying anxiety and uncertainty of waiting. Just waiting. 5:15. 5:18. 5:20. 5:24. 5:30. Waiting for what, though? Chapter 6. At 6:20 p.m., Colonel David Hudson was doing the single thing that still mattered, that mattered more than anything else in his life. David Hudson was on patrol. He was back in combat. He was leading a quality at every position platoon into the field again. Only the field was now an American city. Hudson was one of those men who looked vaguely familiar to people, only they couldn't say precisely why. His blonde hair was cut in a short crew, which was suddenly back in vogue again. He was handsome. His looks were very American. He had the kind of strong, almost noble face that photographs extremely well, and a seemingly unconscious air of self-confidence, a consistently reassuring look that emphatically said, "Yes, I can do that, whatever it is." There was only one thing wrong, which a lot of people didn't notice right away. David Hudson had lost his left arm in the Vietnam War. His checker cab marked Vets, Cabs, and Messengers rolled cautiously forward, reconnoitering past the bright green pumps at the Hess gas station on 11th Avenue and 45th Street. This was one of those times when David Hudson could see himself as if in an eerie dream, when he could objectively watch himself from somewhere outside the scene. He knew this uncomfortable, distorted feeling extremely well from combat duty. Now he felt it again, this time in the sharp, wintry wind blowing through the snowy gray streets of New York City. Colonel David Hudson was purposely allowing the Green Band mission to wind out just a little longer, one important notch tighter. Every second had been rigidly accounted for. More than anything else, David Hudson's mind appreciated the subtleties of precision. Hudson appreciated detail and the fine-tuning involved in getting everything absolutely right. He was back in combat again. This strange, strange passion was alive again inside David Hudson. He finally released the hand microphone from the PRC transmitter built into the Vets' cab's dash. "Contact. Come in, Vets 5. Colonel David Hudson spoke in the firm, charismatic tones which had characterized his commands through the latter war years in Southeast Asia. It was a voice that had always elicited loyalty and obedience in the men whose lives he controlled. "This is Vets 1. Come in, Vets 5. Over." A reply immediately crackled back through heavy static over the PRC transmitter receiver. "This is Vets 5. Over." "Vets 5. Green Band is affirmative. I repeat, Green Band is affirmative. Blow it all up." Chapter 7. "You got a quarter, sir, please? It's real cold out here, sir. You got 2 bits? "Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot, sir. You just about saved my life." Around 7:30 that evening, on Brooklyn's Atlantic Avenue, a familiar bag man called Crusader Rabbit was expertly soliciting loose change and cigarettes. The bag man begged while he sat huddled like trash against the crumbling red brick facade of the Atlantic House Yemen and Middle East restaurant. The money came to him as if he were a magnet made of soiled rag. After a successful hit, $0.48 from a trendy-looking Brooklyn Heights teacher type and his date. The street bum allowed himself a short pull on a dwindling half pint of Four Roses. Drinking while begging change was counterproductive, he knew, but sometimes necessary against the raw cold winter time. Besides, it was his image. The deep, slack cough that followed the sip of whiskey sounded convincingly tubercular. The man's lips were bloated. They were corpse white and cracked, and they looked as if they'd bled recently. For this year's winter wardrobe, he'd selected a sleeveless navy parka over several layers of assorted colored lumberman shirts. He'd picked out open-toed high-top black sneakers, basketball player snowbird socks, and painter's pants that were now thickly caked with mud, vomit, and spit. The tourist, at least, seemed to love him. Sometimes they snapped his picture to bring home as an example of New York City's famed squalor and heartlessness. He enjoyed posing, asking them for a buck or whatever the traffic would bear. He'd hold his two puffy shopping bags and smile extra pathetically for the camera. Pay the cashier, sport. Now, through gummy, half-closed eyes, Crusader Rabbit stealthily watched the usual early evening promenade along Atlantic Avenue's Middle Eastern Restaurant Row. It was a constant, day-in, day-out noisy bazaar here. Transplanted Arabs, college assholes, Brooklyn professionals who came to eat ethnic. In the distance, there was always the clickety-clack of the L. A troop of McDonald's counter kids was passing by Crusader Rabbit, walking home from work. Two chunky black girls, a skinny mulatto boy around 18, 19. Hey, McDonald's. Whopper beat the Big Mac. Real tough break. Got a quarter? Something for some McCoffee? Crusader coughed and wheezed at the passing trio of teens. The McDonald's kids looked offended. Then they all laughed together in a high-pitched chorus. Who asked you, Aqualung? You old yeek sheethead? Kick your ass. The kids continued merrily on. Rude little bastards when Ronald McDonald wasn't watching over their act. If any of the various passers-by had looked closer, they might have noticed certain visual inconsistencies about the bagman called Crusader Rabbit. For one thing, he had impressive muscle tone for a sedentary street bum. His shoulders were unusually broad. Even more unusual were his eyes, which were almost always intently focused. They scanned the avenue over and over again, watching all the street action. There was also the small matter of the quality of the dirt and dust thickly caked on his ankles, on his exposed toes. He was a little too perfect, almost as if it might be black kiwi shoe polish carefully applied to look like dirt. The conclusion was obvious after a careful look at the street bum. Crusader Rabbit was some kind of undercover New York cop. He had to be some kind of cop on a stakeout. His real name was Arch Carroll, and he was on a stakeout, a 5-week one, with no end in sight. Meanwhile, across the busy Brooklyn street, inside the Sinbad Star restaurant, two Iraqi men in their early 30s were sampling what they believed to be the finest Middle Eastern cooking available in New York City. They were the objects of Carroll's long and painful stakeout. The Iraqi men had chosen a rear alcove of the small, cozy restaurant where they noisily slurped thick carob bean soup. They gobbled up mint-flecked tabbouleh and cream-colored hummus. They eagerly munched greasy mixtures of raisins, pine nuts, lamb, Moroccan olives, their favorite things to eat in the world. Life was good. Chapter 8. Back out on Atlantic Avenue, Arch Carroll shivered unhappily in the probing icy cold fingers of the rising night wind. At times like these, Carroll sometimes wondered why it was that a reasonably intelligent 35-year-old man, someone with decent enough prospects, someone with a law degree, could regularly be working 60 to 70-hour weeks, invariably eating stone-cold pizza and Pepsi-Cola for dinner, was sitting outside a Middle Eastern restaurant on a Friday night stakeout. Why was that? Was it perhaps because his father and two uncles had been pavement-pounding city cops? Was it because his grandfather had been a rough-and-tumble example of New York's finest? Or did it have to do with things he'd seen a decade and a half ago in Vietnam? Maybe he just wasn't a reasonable, intelligent man, as he'd somehow always presumed. Maybe, if you got right down to it, there was some kind of obvious short circuit in the wires of the old brain, some form of synaptic fuck-up. As Arch Carroll pondered the tangible mistakes of his life, he noticed that his attention had begun to wander. For several minutes at a clip, he'd stare at his sadly wiggling toes, at the equally fascinating burning ember of his cigarette, at almost anything mildly distracting. 5-week-long stakeouts weren't exactly recommended for their entertainment value. That was exactly how long he'd been watching Anton and Wadi Rashid. Now Carol's attention had suddenly snapped back. "What the?" he mumbled out loud as he stared down the congested street. "Is that who it looks like?" "Can't be." "I think it is." "But it can't be." Carol had suddenly noticed a skinny, frazzle-haired man coming directly his way from the Frente Unido bar and Data Indonesia. The man was scurrying up Atlantic Avenue, periodically looking back over his right shoulder. At a distance, he looked like a baggy coat walking on a stick. Carol slowly pushed himself up out of his half-frozen lounging position against the restaurant wall. He squinted his eyes tight for a better look at the figure approaching from down the street. He couldn't believe it. He stared down the street, his eyes smarting from the bite of the wind. He had to make sure. Jesus, he was sure. The fast-walking man had a huge, puffy bro, bushy, very wiry black hair. The greasy hair was combed straight back. It hung like a limp sack over the collar of his black cloth jacket. Carol knew the man by two names. One was Hussein Musa. The other was the Lebanese butcher. A decade before, Musa had been recruited by the Russians. He'd been trained at their famed Third World School in Tripoli. Since then, Musa had been busily freelancing terror and sophisticated murder techniques all over the world. In Paris, Rome, Zaire, New York, in Lebanon, for Colonel Gaddafi. Recently, he'd worked for Francois Montserrat, who had taken over not only Juan Carlos's European terrorist cell, but South America, and now the United States as well. Hussein Musa halted in front of the Sinbad Star restaurant. Like a very careful driver at a tricky intersection, he looked both ways. Twice more he looked up and down Atlantic Avenue. He even noticed the bagman camped out across the traffic-busy street. He finally disappeared behind the gaudy red door of the Sinbad Star. Arch Carroll sat up rigidly straight against the crumbling brick wall of the Syrian restaurant. He groped inside his jacket and produced a stubby third of a Camel cigarette. He lit up and inhaled the gruff North Carolina dirt farm tobacco. What an unexpected little Christmas present. What a just reward for endless winter nights trailing the Rashids. The Lebanese butcher on a silver platter. His bosses in state had said not to touch the Rashids without extremely strong physical evidence, but they'd issued no such orders for the Lebanese butcher. What was Hussein Musa doing in New York anyway? Carol's mind was reeling. Why was Musa here with the Rashids? The firebombing of Pier 3334 went through his mind quickly. He had picked up strands of information from gossip he'd heard all day long on the street. Somebody had taken it into his head to blow a dock and the surrounding West Side area, it seemed, and for a moment, Carol pondered a connection between Hussein Musa and the events on the Hudson River. Arch Carol had been ramrodding the anti-terrorist division of the DIA for almost 4 years now. In that span of time, only a few of the mass murderers he'd learned about had gotten to him emotionally and caused him to lose his usual policeman's objectivity. Hussein Musa was one of those few. The Lebanese butcher liked to torture. The butcher apparently liked to kill. The butcher enjoyed maiming innocent civilians. So Carol didn't particularly want Musa dead as he studied the Sinbad Star restaurant. Carol wanted the butcher locked away for the rest of his natural life. Give the animal lots of time to think about what he'd done, if he did think. From underneath newspapers and rags inside one of his shopping bags, Carroll began to slide out a heavy black metal object. He checked the firing chamber of a Browning automatic. He quickly fed in an autoloader. A stooped, ancient Hasid was passing by on the sidewalk. He stared incredulously at the street bum loading up a Browning handgun. His watery gray eyes almost fell out of his sagging face. The old man kept slowly walking away, looking back constantly as he moved. Then he cantered a little faster. New York street bums with guns now. The city was beyond all prayers, all possible hope. Carroll finally began to weave forward through the thick, fuzzy night traffic. He only half heard the bleating car horns and angry curses directed at him. He was drifting in and out of reality now. There was a little nausea involved here, too. A middle-aged couple was leaving the Sinbad, the fat wife pulling her red overcoat tight around bursting hips. She stared at Crusader Rabbit, and the look said, "You don't belong inside there, mister. You know you don't belong in there." Carroll pulled open the ornate red door the departing couple had let slam in his face. Hot, garlicky air escaped as he started inside. A muffled snick of the Browning under his coat. A deep, silent breath. "Okay, hotshot." The tiny restaurant was infinitely more crowded than it had looked from the outside. Arch Carroll cursed and felt his stomach drop. Every dining table was filled to overflowing. Six or seven more people, a group of boisterously laughing friends, were waiting in the front to be seated. Carroll pushed past them. Carroll's eyes slowly drifted along the back of the crowded dining room. Only his eyes moved. His head was absolutely still. Hussein Musa had already seen him. Even in the packed, bustling restaurant, the terrorist had noticed his entrance. The butcher had been instinctively watching every person who came in from Atlantic Avenue. So had the restaurant's owner, an enormous, 250-pound man. He charged forward now, an enraged bull guarding his herd at mealtime. "Get out of here! You get out, bum! Go, now!" the owner screamed. Carroll tried to look desperately lost, dizzily confused, as surprised as everyone else that he was inside the small neighborhood restaurant. He stumbled over his own flopping black sneakers. He weaved sideways toward the left, before moving suddenly toward the right rear corner of the dining room. He hoped to God he looked cockeyed, drunk, and absolutely helpless. Maybe even a little funny right now. Everybody should start laughing. Carroll groped down his body with both hands, graphically scratching between his legs. A middle-aged woman turned away with obvious disgust. "Bathroom?" Carroll convincingly slobbered, rolled his eyes back into his forehead. "Gotta go to the bathroom." A young bearded man and his girlfriend started laughing at a front table. Bathroom humor got the youth crowd every time. Hussein Musa had stopped eating. His teeth finally showed a serrated blade of shining yellow. It was the smile of an animal, a brutal scavenger. He apparently thought this scene was funny, too. "Gotta go to the bathroom," Carroll continued a little louder, sounding like a drunken Jerry Lewis. "Jesus. You have to be a decent actor in this line of work." "Muhammad, Tariq, get bum out! Get bum out now!" the owner was screeching at his waiters. Suddenly, fluidly, Arch Carroll wheeled hard to his extreme left. The Browning automatic flew out of the ratty and cumbersome parka. It was completely out of place in the family restaurant, a gun as ugly and menacing as unexpected death. Women and children began screaming. "Freeze! Don't move! Freeze, goddamn you!" At the same time, one of the Lebanese waiters hit Carroll hard from his blind side, spinning him in a fast half-circle to the right. He had ruined the drop Carroll had on the three terrorists. He had turned everything into a complete, instantaneous disaster. Musa and the Rashids were already scattering, rolling sideways off the red vinyl dining chair. Anton Rashid yanked out a silver automatic from under his brown leather car coat. Movies sometimes show particularly violent scenes in flowing slow motion. It wasn't like that, Carroll knew. It was a jumpy collage of loud, shocking still photos. The disconnected photos clicked at him now in random order. They stopped. They started. They stopped. They started again. "Everybody hit the floor," Carol screamed. At the same instant, he fired the Browning. He didn't watch the results. The first bullet brutally uncorked the right side of Anton Rashid's throat, spilling his blood like wine from a broken jug. Hussein Musa's gun flashed. It roared as Carol dove across the backs of a couple already lying on the floor. Seconds later, Carol peered back over the table. His eyes and forehead were exposed for an instant. He fired off three more quick shots. Two of the bullets drove stocky Wadi Rashid hard against the hollow partition wall, decorated with black skillets. Twin holes opened in the terrorist's chest. The heavy skillets clattered noisily to the tile floor. "Musa! Hussein Musa! You can't get out! You can't get past me!" Carol began to scream, to negotiate with the man. There was no answer. Somewhere in the front of the restaurant, an old woman was wailing like an Arab imam. Several people were crying loudly. "Give up now, and you live. Otherwise, I'll kill you." Carol had to chance another fast look. He was gasping for a breath. "One, two, three." He raised his head. He saw nothing of the butcher this time. Musa was down under the tables as well, hiding and crawling, looking for some advantage. He was moving either toward the front door or the kitchen. Which one was it? Carol guessed it would be the kitchen. He began to scramble toward the kitchen. "I have anti-personnel grenades," the butcher suddenly let out a piercing, high scream. "Everybody dies in here. Everybody dies in this restaurant. Everybody dies with me. Women, children. I don't care." Carol stopped moving suddenly. He almost didn't breathe. Straight ahead, he stared at a badly shaking, very frightened woman curled like a snail on the floor. She looked about 30 years old. Carol peeked above the dining tables again. A gunshot rang out to his immediate left. A salt shaker disintegrated in his eyes. Musa was in the far right corner. The question was whether he did have grenades. It could be a bluff, but the worst was always possible with somebody like the butcher. The people sprawled on the floor were inching toward panic. They were close to rising en masse and bolting for the door. This would be perfect for Hussein Musa. In the confusion, Carol wouldn't run the risk of shooting. Food was spattered everywhere on the dining room floor. Carol finally reached for a platter holding the relics of an unfinished meal of pungent lamb and rice. With a sudden wrist snap, he hurled the dripping plate hard against the kitchen door. At the same time, he shifted upright into a professional shooting crouch, a two-handed pistol grip with both arms rigid. Musa came up again, shooting. The butcher fired twice at the slapping noise against the kitchen door. Musa had a grenade in his left hand. Son of a bitch. Arch Carol squeezed the trigger. Musa looked incredibly surprised. The far right of Hussein Musa's forehead gushed blood. He slid down against a table still covered with mounds of food and tableware. His back dragged the cloth, plates, wine, and water glasses. He spit out a throaty curse across the room. Then the terrorist's gun rose again. Carol shot Hussein Musa a second time, the bullet exploding his right cheek. The Lebanese butcher fell heavily forward onto the back of a fat diner lying on the floor. Carol shot Musa again, as the man trapped underneath wriggled like a beached fish and screamed. There was an eerie, terrible silence inside the Sinbad Star. A second or two passed like that. Then loud crying started. There were angry shouts and relieved hugging all over the restaurant. His gun thrust stiffly forward. Arch Carol moved awkwardly across the chaotic room. He was still in a police school crouch. It was as if he were locked into that position. He carefully examined that the Rashid brothers, Wadi and Anton, were still alive. He looked at Musa. The butcher was dead, and the world was instantly a better place in which to live. "Please call me an ambulance," Carol spoke softly to the astonished restaurant owner. "I'm sorry. I'm very sorry this had to happen in your establishment. These men are terrorists, professional killers." The Sinbad Star restaurant owner continued to stare with disbelief at Carol. His black eyes were small, shiny beads stuck in his broad forehead, and they pierced to the rear of Arch Carroll's skull.
"And what are you? What are you? Please tell me, mister."
Chapter 9. Green Van had struck like an invisible army. Two nervous New York City tech patrolmen, Alry Simmons and Robert Havens, were carefully threading a path through the smoldering ruins of the Federal Reserve Bank located on Maiden Lane. The two men were attached at their belts to 500-yard-long safety lines snaking back toward the street. The patrolmen were deep inside what had once been the Fed's massive and richly ornamented public lobby. Indeed, the gray and blue limestone, the sandstone bricks of the Federal Reserve, had always impressed visitors with a sense of their durability and authority. The fort-like appearance, the stout iron bars on every window, had reinforced the image of self-importance and impregnability. The image had obviously been a sham. The destruction which Officers Simmons and Havens found downstairs in the coin section was difficult to comprehend, and even more difficult to assess. Mountainous coin-weighing machines had been blown apart like a child's toys. 50-pound coin bags were strewn open everywhere. The marble floor was easily 3 feet deep in quarters, dimes, nickels. Building support columns had been knocked down everywhere on the basement floor. The entire structure seemed to be trembling. In the deepest basement of the Federal Reserve Bank was the largest single accumulation of gold stored anywhere in the world. It all belonged to foreign government. The Fed both guarded the gold and kept track of who owned what. In an ordinary change of ownership, the Fed merely moved gold from one country's bin into another's. The gold was transported on ordinary metal carts, like books in a library. The security system in the deep basement was so highly elaborate that even the Reserve Bank's president had to be accompanied when he ventured into the gold storage area. Now, patrolmen Havens and Simmons were alone in the cavernous basement. Suddenly, gold was everywhere around them. Rivers of shining gold ran through the dust and rubble. Gold bars, more than they could possibly count, surrounded them. There was well over $100 billion at the day's market price of $386 an ounce, all within their reach. Patrolman Robert Havens was hyperventilating, taking enormously deep breaths that were almost yawns. His broad, flat face held almost no expression and hadn't since he and Simmons had entered the Fed building. Both emergency policemen stopped inching forward suddenly. Robert Havens unconsciously let out a sharp gasp.
"Christ Jesus! What the hell is this?"
An armed security guard was sitting on a canned wooden chair directly blocking their path from the gold section into the Fed's main garage. The cane chair still smoldered. The guard was staring directly into Robert Havens' eyes. Neither man spoke. The Federal Reserve Bank guard couldn't. He was beyond words. The man was horribly burned, charred a blistering charcoal black. The sight was so upsetting that the two policemen missed the most important clue at first. Wrapped around the bank guard's right arm was a shiny, bright green band. Chapter 10. As Archer Carroll maneuvered his battered station wagon along the Major Deegan Expressway, the words of the Atlantic Avenue restaurant owner came back to him with the persistence of an unanswerable philosophical question.
"And what are you? What are you? Please tell me, mister."
He glanced at his tired face in the rearview mirror.
"Yeah. What are you, Arch? The Rashids and Hussein Musa are bad people, but you're some kind of national hero, right?"
He was drained, completely numb from the night's carnage. He wanted everything to be quiet and still inside his throbbing head now.
"And what are you, mister?"
He turned on the car radio, looking for a diversion from his mood. Almost immediately he heard the news about Wall Street, delivered by a voice edged in the hushed hysteria so favored by newscasters when they describe events of national importance. Carroll increased the volume and stared at the tiny light emitted by the radio. He concentrated on the newscaster's tensely delivered reportage. Then there were man-on-the-street interviews, recorded against a brassy background of screaming sirens. It was impossible to mistake the shocked tones of the people who spoke.
Carol tightened both of his hands on the car's steering wheel. His mind was crowded with images of urban guerrilla destruction. He understood that Wall Street was a perfect target for any determined terrorist group, but he couldn't make the necessary jump from his thoughts to the horrible reality of what had happened. He didn't want to think about it. He was almost home, and he didn't need to drag the world inside the last sanctuary left to him. Not tonight, anyway. Chapter 11. Moments later, Carol swung his stiff, aching body inside the familiar, musty front hallway of his house in the Riverdale section of the Bronx. Automatically, he hung his coat up on the hook under an ancient totem, the Snoopy-eyed Sacred Heart of Jesus. "Turn out the nightlight. Home from the wars at last," he thought. As he slumped into the living room, Carol sighed out loud. "Oh, poor Arch. It's almost 11:30. "Sorry, didn't see you there, Mary Kay." Mary Catherine Carroll was sitting neatly curled up on one corner of the couch. The room was only dimly illuminated by an amber light from the dining parlor. "You look like a Scuzzy Bowery bagman. Is that blood on your sleeve? Are you all right?" She stood up suddenly. Carroll looked down at his torn, dingy shirt sleeve. He turned it into the dining parlor light. It was blood, all right. "I'm fine. The blood isn't mine." Mary Catherine frowned deeply as she came forward to examine her brother's arm. "The bad guys get banged up, too?" Carol finally smiled at his 24-year-old baby sister. Mary Catherine, who was the keeper of his house, the substitute mother for his four children, the uncomplaining cook and chief bottle washer, all for a $200-a-month stipend, a scholarship. It was all he could possibly afford to pay her right now. "I had to kill one of them." "The kids all asleep?" The kids, in order of arrival, were Mary the Third, Clancy, Mickey Kevin, and Elizabeth. All four of them were too Irish-American cute for their own good, tow-headed and blue-eyed, with infectious smiles and quick, almost adult wits. Mary Catherine had been their house mother for nearly 3 years now. Ever since Arch's wife, Nora, had died on December 14, 1982. After Nora's funeral, after just one desolate night at their old New York apartment, the six of them had moved into the Carroll family homestead in Riverdale. The old house had been closed and boarded up since the deaths of Carroll's mother and father back in 80 and 81. Mary Catherine had immediately redecorated. She even set up a huge, light-filled painting studio for herself in the attic. The kids were out of New York City proper, at least. They suddenly had acres of fresh air and space in which to ramble around. There were definite advantages to being up in Riverdale. Carol had held on to their old rent-controlled apartment on Riverside Drive. Sometimes he even stayed there when he had to work weekends in New York. It wasn't ideal, but it could have been a lot worse. Especially without Mary Kay. "I have several important messages for you," Mary Catherine announced brightly. "Mickey says, if I might paraphrase, that you work too hard and don't make enough scoots. Clancy says, if you don't play catch with him this weekend, and not video game baseball, you're a dead man. That's a direct quote. Let's see. Oh, yes, I almost forgot. Lizzie has decided to become a prima ballerina. Lessons for the spring semester at the Juilliard School start at $300 per, Dad." "That all?" Mercy Dotes left you a humongous kiss and a hug of equal magnitude and intensity. "Uncomplicated young woman. Shame she can't stay 6 years old forever." "Arch?" Mary Catherine suddenly looked concerned. "You heard about this Wall Street thing? The bombing?" Carol nodded wearily. He wanted to box Wall Street off in a dark, private corner until he was ready to deal with it. Carol finally bent and loosened his flopping high-top sneaks. He peeled off a discolored, satin Palatine high school jacket. His fatigue had yielded to a kind of peaceful, ethereal, waking slumber. In the large bathroom on the second floor, he turned on the tub full blast. Curling hot steam rose toward the ceiling from the chipped and scratched white porcelain. He took off the rest of his squalid street bum ensemble. Finally, he rolled a fluffy bath towel around his waist. Quick mirror check. Okay. He was still around 6'2", solid, durable, and sturdy. Pleasant face, even if it was a little pug ordinary, like some friendly mutt people generally take in out of the rain. While the hot water ran, Carol stiffly padded back downstairs to the kitchen and popped the top of a cold Schlitz. Mary Catherine had bought the Schlitz as a change of pace. Actually, she was trying to stop him from drinking so much. Carol took 3 chilled cans and headed back to the pleasantly steamed bathroom. Stripping off the soft bath towel, he slowly, luxuriously entered the hot tub. As he sipped the cold beer, he began to relax. Carol used the bath the way some people use psychiatric therapy, to get back in touch, to sort it all out. Among other things, hot water and soap was the only therapy he could afford. Carol began to think about Nora almost immediately. Damn. Always at night when he got home from work. Their time. The emptiness he felt right then was unbearable. It beat against him with the consistency of a pulp. He was filled with a terrible, hollow longing. He let his eyes gently close and he could see her face. Oh, Nora, sweet Nora, how could you leave me like this? How could you leave me alone with all these kids fighting against this crazy, crazy world out there? She had been the best person Carol had ever met. It was as simple and no more profound than that. The two of them had made a perfect fit. Nora had been warm and thoughtful and funny. That they had found each other convinced Carol such a thing as fate might indeed exist. It wasn't all randomness and whim and unseeing chance. Strange, the ways of life and death. Growing up, all through high school in New York, at college, South Bend, Notre Dame, Carol had been secretly afraid he'd never find anybody to love him. It was a curious fear, and sometimes he'd imagine that just as some people were born with a talent for art or music, he'd been given a gift of solitude. Then Nora found him, and that was absolute magic. She discovered Carol the second day of law school at Michigan State. Right away, from their very first date, Carol simply knew he could never love anybody else, that he would never need to. He'd never been more comfortable around another person in his life. Only now Nora was gone. Nearly 3 years back in the cancer ward of New York Hospital. Merry Christmas, Carol family. Your friend, God. I'm just a kid, Arch, Nora had whispered to him once, after she found out she was dying for certain. She'd been 31 then, a year younger than he. Carol slowly sipped his can of watery beer. An old country song played through his head. The beer that made